Welcome to On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, caring for those who care for you. For more information, check out nhhca.org. We are inside the Barley House, of course, home to our renowned Pints of Politics series, but today, home to On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Chris Ryan, Paul Steinhauser. In just a few moments, we'll be joined by U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar here inside the Barley House. Todd Fahey from AARP New Hampshire will join us as well for that conversation. Michael Bennett was in New Hampshire yesterday, and he called me as he was about to leave on a plane trying to grab a lobster roll at the Portland airport, and we'll hear from him in just a little bit as well. Paul Steinhauser is with us. He was at the debate out in Westerville, Ohio, which is just outside of Columbus. And Paul, what were your takeaways?
Well, first of all, I didn't bump into John Kasich because that's where he lives.
I was wondering if you're going to see Kasich.
Actually, the day of the debate, he was in New York City.
Oh, he was.
Book tour.
Okay.
Book tour. But I reported last week that book tour will bring him right back here to New Hampshire early in November. So
okay.
I think when that happens, you and I will sit down with him, and it's going to spark a lot of speculation for Kasich. But I don't know. Let's talk
about that. He's going to have to sign up for the primary while he's here, though, too, because that's going to be the filing period.
Yeah, it's right in the middle of the filing period. It starts October 30th and goes till the 15th.
That's going to be where the conversation is going to go. I'm going to walk him over if he wants to the state house to sign up.
And, you know, we just learned who the first – likely will be the first candidate to sign up will be Pete Buttigieg.
Yes.
He'll be here on Halloween Day and the day before, actually. I think so. He'll do that on the 30th.
Yep.
But
the first day, I believe.
First day of the 2.5 week filing period. Let's talk about this debate because it was very entertaining. Let's be honest about that. 12 candidates, 3 hours, historic. The most candidates ever on the debate stage at the same time. A very good night for Buttigieg. A very good night for Amy Klobuchar, who we just talked with a moment ago. You know, I think split decision for Hillary, for Senator Warren. Of course, when you're now a co-front runner, you're going to get all the attention.
Yeah.
She did. She got slammed from the left and the right. But she held her own, especially as the debate went on. And for Joe Biden, he was almost, in a way, the missing man. He didn't do any damage, I don't think, to his status right now as the other co-front runner. But he wasn't a real active part of the conversation after the first couple of minutes, which, of course, centered on impeachment.
This is true, and Bernie Sanders is the focus as well as in regards to his health.
Yeah. And he looked good.
He looked good. He sounded good. He seemed like Bernie, and it was a good night for him overall. But I thought that this was the first debate where the non-frontrunners were the dominant candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar were able to keep themselves in the conversation throughout the evening. The question, though, is this going to, relate to the polls and gaining support? I feel that it will. I feel that despite we have seen Bernie, Elizabeth Warren now, and Joe Biden at the top of the heap in terms of the candidates for a long time, I feel like their support is somewhat soft. And I feel like we can see movement of other candidates as more individuals get engaged here in the fall and the winter months. So I think there's definitely opportunity for Buttigieg as well as Klobuchar and perhaps others.
Yeah, the soft is a good point. I remember you spoke with Bennett when he was
here.
I spoke with him about a week ago when he was here the last time. He made the same point that it's a little slow. A little soft, that the support for the top contenders is a little soft. And we'll see. We'll see. You know, one of the other contenders in the debate, Beto O'Rourke, the former congressman from Texas, remember his meteoric rise back in early March when he first jumped into the race. It's been pretty much a slow burn for him since. His signature issue nowadays, of course, is curbing gun violence. He was off the campaign trail for a while when that massacre happened in his hometown of El Paso. He did not have a great debate performance, and on that signature issue, he got into a little spat with Buttigieg. It turned personal.
Yeah.
After the debate, myself and another reporter or two had a chance to ask him, you know, what happens next? Take a listen.
You know, I got to tell you, it's not just this debate, although I'm very grateful that I got more time tonight and was able to lay out what it is I want to do as president. It's also about those visits that we're making to communities that very often do not have a seat at the table, are unheard in a presidential cycle, bringing those people in and making sure they're part of the conversation, and then talking about the issues that are most important, regardless of how politically convenient they are to talk about, like mandatory buybacks. I hope that is then reflected in the polls that help us qualify. So I just got to continue to do the right thing, to see things clearly, to speak honestly, to act decisively, and then allow the politics to follow.
So, yeah, I mean, for him, it's about doing the right thing. But doing the right thing doesn't always equate electoral success. He's running a very different campaign now, Chris. It's all about gun control and curbing gun violence. But it's not all about coming to the early voting states.
No.
We've barely seen him here.
No, you're right. I mean, he was here a lot early and did long trips through the Granite State when he first announced. Mm-hmm. But in the summer months, he was, I believe the last time he was here outside of
the
convention was in mid-July, and I spoke with him at that point in time. I don't think he's been here since then other than that, the convention. So that's, you know, two times here in the last 3 months for Beto O'Rourke, if I'm not mistaken. So, yeah, interesting stuff there. Getting back to the soft support here for a second, and a lot of this is anecdotal, but I feel like there's not a lot of bumper stickers, there's not a lot of lawn signs, and that's different than we've seen in campaigns in the fall in previous times around. Even with Hillary Clinton, who folks will say, you know, she was not a favored candidate, you'd see Hillary Clinton bumper stickers all over the place. When have you seen a Joe Biden bumper sticker? When have you seen an Elizabeth Warren bumper sticker? I've seen a few, but not many. And again, that's anecdotal. But it shows to me that there is not the same type of support that we have seen for, you know, candidates in the past.
Yeah, well, last cycle we basically had two Democrats running for the nomination. So a lot of people have made up their minds earlier in the process than normal. That's not the case this time. I talked to a bunch of voters just down the street here at Revelstoke Cafe when Klobuchar was here earlier today, Thursday, of course.
Yep.
And they were all remained undecided. New Hampshire normally is a late-breaking state, and it's going to be that way on the Democratic side this time just because, as so many of these voters said, well, it's like a wealth of riches.
And they've seen a ton of candidates and a lot of the undecided voters. It's not like they're not engaged. They just can't decide or going to wait until later on and see who emerges, which is an interesting dynamic because if you're waiting, are you waiting to see if a candidate is going to that you like is going to start to rise in the polls? Because if they don't rise in the polls, it may be because folks just aren't waiting are waiting for them to have success and it's not happening. So I think that there is the polls are what they are. But I feel like, again, there is a tremendous amount of undecided voters who are out there right now. The events, we've talked about the attendance, and there have been really strongly attended events, but there's not as many events over long periods of time. They're all very condensed to like a day or two. Elizabeth Warren will be here. She'll have good crowds, but it's two events per day. Mm-hmm. Then she'll be gone a lot of the time. So, yeah, I feel like there is a lot of opportunity that exists in New Hampshire, but you wonder if the campaigns are going to realize that, or if they're going to continue on a national type campaign, or look at New Hampshire and say Elizabeth Warren's going to win there. She's from Massachusetts. She's done well. She's been there a lot. Because I don't necessarily think that that's the case. I don't think Elizabeth Warren has New Hampshire locked up.
No, she doesn't have locked up. The latest poll here actually showed a three-way tie between her, Biden, and
but it seems like the conventional wisdom is that Elizabeth Warren and New Hampshire is going to happen.
Yeah, but do you look at the polling right now? No, it's a three-way tie between, obviously, the two neighboring states, Bernie and in Vermont and Warren, and also Biden. And none of them, you know, and that doesn't prevent anybody else from concentrating here. Listen, for some of the candidates who know they're never going to make the debate stage again, Michael Bennett, the senator from Colorado, Montana Governor Bullock, John Delaney, the former congressman from Maryland, they are now all about the early states. Iowa a little bit more than here, but also here. And they will continue to do that. They don't worry anymore about making the debate stage because they are not going to make the debate stage. Two candidates, though, who were on that. There were four candidates on the debate stage this past week that are fighting to make the next round. Now, one of them is Klobuchar, who we sat down with. The other of the four is Julian Castro, the former Housing and Urban Development Secretary and San Antonio Mayor. And I had a chance in the spin room at the debate to ask him about, you know, do you have a shot at getting back on the stage, or was this the last time? Here's what he told me.
I'm going to keep fighting on, and you know, I believe that with hard work that we can make the next debate in Atlanta. We have about 3.5 weeks to do that, so I'm going to keep working hard to get there.
And did your performance tonight help you make the case?
I think so. You know, it's always a scramble for time with 12 people up there, but I made the best use of the time that I did get. I think I was very sharp on issues that people care about, and I think that'll make a difference.
Thank you.
So do you feel that it is a death knell for these candidates not to be on the debate stage in this era of legitimacy? And, you know, we hear folks bring up Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, but there's this thing that exists now that didn't exist before.
in those time periods. It's called the internet. It's called Google. And you look up, you know, Michael Bennett, who you see at this event, and you're like, oh, I really like him. And then you look him up, and where is he polling? Like, whoa, he is polling terribly. He's not going to be president. People want to support somebody that shares their values, but also somebody that can win. And I think that the amount of polling and the amount of you know, focus and attention there is on the entertainment side of politics, which we both endeavor in, I think that that creates an environment where it's very difficult for a John Delaney or a Michael Bennett to ever gain any type of traction, because it becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy of they're not going to rise.
Everybody looks back to 1976 and Jimmy Carter's presidential campaign, where he basically camped out here in New Hampshire and in Iowa and was retail, 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 retail. House parties, town halls, you name it, living rooms of voters.
That's Gardner Hill, who used to work at the station, would talk about Jimmy Carter being at the bar, and then he would actually be sleeping over at people's houses, including his.
Yeah.
And it was a completely different, and that still happens. I mean, candidates sleep over at other houses.
Oh, yeah,
people's
Corey
houses,
Booker does that Booker all the time when he's up here. So, yeah, retail's not dead.
Right.
But let's also be honest, there's been a nationalization of this campaign, and it's been coming for 3 decades. First, the rise of cable news. That was the first step. And then the rise of the internet, and social media especially, has really, you know, made this a national campaign. Iowa still matters. New Hampshire still matters. We're the playing ground. We're the stage where the action happens. But
yeah.
I don't think we're as influential as we used to be.
I mean, you think about the questions that I get asked, I'm sure you get asked by voters. They'll say, oh, you know, I really liked Steyer. I like his campaign ad, or I like this person. Do they have a chance? So that's it's always on people's minds, you know, can this person win? And they want to support a winner. And, you know, it gets back to the Dennis Kucinich line where he'd say, people would ask him if he's electable. And he said, yeah, if you vote for me. And that's kind of the point where New Hampshire has the opportunity to determine if a Michael Bennett or an Amy Klobuchar or whomever is in fact a viable presidential candidate based upon if they just like and support the individual, not get caught up in what the outside noise and chatter is about the candidate. And it's been done in the past. It happened here with Kasich. Kasich was basically a nobody, despite what he might tell you, going into this race, and he just camped out here. His ads were good. He was able to generate support and to move forward and finish second here in New Hampshire. So it still works, but your polling has to get to a point where individuals are willing to take that jump. And that's going to be the challenge for the candidates that you're describing are not on the stage right now. Like a Pete Buttigieg, who's at, you know, around 7% here in New Hampshire. Yeah, I mean, he could challenge to be at the top.
Buttigieg has a very good shot.
Right.
He's a little bit higher.
But
the other
folks not on the stage, like going from like 2% to that's not going to happen this day and age.
No, and you brought up Buttigieg again. He was one of the big winners in that debate. He's raised a boatload of money,
yeah,
and he's invested that here in Iowa.
Yeah.
He's got a huge staff on the ground here, great grassroots outreach. He can do it. Some of the others, not so much.
So we're going to hear from Amy Klobuchar in just a moment here on the program. Then we're going to to preview what is going to be happening on the campaign trail in this upcoming week. Also here from Michael Bennett. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the show. Amy Klobuchar sat down with Paul Steinhauser, myself, and Todd Fahey inside the Barley House earlier today. We're at the Barley House with U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar, who had a really strong debate on Tuesday night. I'm curious as to, you know, what this means, you think, for your campaign moving forward. Is this the breakout moment that you envision?
You know, people keep saying you're looking for a viral moment, which I think is funny. I went on Bill Maher with Howard Stern. I thought that might work. But for me, it's not necessarily one moment. It's building momentum and getting to know people. And that's one of the reasons I'm here today on this 10-county tour, because the more I go and the more places I go and the more people I meet, the better it is. And what happened to me on that debate stage is I got to answer questions in a broad number of areas, and that didn't happen in the other ones. I got to talk about foreign relations and show what I would be like as a commander-in-chief. I got to talk about the opioid epidemic, which has hit New Hampshire so hard, and long-term care. I think I was the only one to bring up, which I think is one of the biggest issues facing New Hampshire and our country, and that's the aging of our population and making sure that they have places to live and get good health care. Overall, I was happy with the debate, and I also had a lot of fun out there.
That's important.
Yeah, it is. The last debate, I actually stood next to Cory Booker and wrote him some amusing notes that one day I'll reveal. I think it is important that you have some joy campaigning because the president is such a negative force for our country. That would be a Minnesota euphemism.
Like Minnesota nice?
Yeah, in terms of what he talks about, how he talks about, how he goes after people. And it's a very scary time for people. Mm-hmm. They're scared about what's going on around the world, understandably. They're scared about why is he writing weird letters and why is he, you know, putting our allies out for slaughter. But then we're in this campaign, and I think it's really important to do two things. Have an optimistic economic agenda for America, but also to have some joy about what you're doing and make them realize not every president is going to send a mean tweet in the mornings. I will never do that. You could have a different kind of president who's actually going to bring some happiness and joy to the work. And it doesn't mean it's easy or that everything is a picnic. It just means we've got to, as a country, take on these opportunities in a positive way. And I do see them, you know, coming up with new research and science for climate change. That's an opportunity. Figuring out when we have a low unemployment rate, how our seniors can still be in the workforce. A lot of them want to work. And how we can figure out smart ways to do housing and childcare. I actually see it as an exciting thing, especially in states like mine in Minnesota and New Hampshire, where you have all these entrepreneurs and people and students wanting to start new things. Let's make it so that our country is this leader again economically in the world.
You had a good performance in Houston. You had a great performance this week in Columbus. I was there. I got a chance to see it. What's next, though? You've got a debate in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. You haven't reached the criteria yet, or at least one of them.
Yeah.
Are you optimistic, A, that you can make it? And if you don't make that debate stage, how much does that hurt your campaign?
Okay. First of all, I'm very optimistic we're going to make it. We already have one poll in, and we've made all the other criteria the day that they announced it. We have more than enough donors. We just raised $1.2 million in 24 hours after this debate. Then I'm just going to keep getting out there. And New Hampshire is really important for me. Very important that my supporters answer calls about polls, yes. I feel that we're going to make it. And I'm going to be in for the end anyway. We have a number of offices here in this state. We've got a great state director, former legislator in Scott Merrick, and we put together a big operation. But I'm very hopeful that I'll make that stage.
And if you don't, you're still in it.
I'm still in it.
As Amy Klobuchar joining us, how bad is it, though, for the process if you, who are polling very well in Iowa right now, fourth or fifth in Iowa, you have a great grad organization. If you are left off the stage, what does that say about the process?
I'm just not thinking that's going to happen.
I don't think so either. But if
I do think, okay, we have had a lot of candidates, 20-some candidates. I'm ahead of 18 of them. But I think that has contributed to it's hard for people who aren't as well-known, who are from smaller states. You think about people like Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, who ended up doing well in those early states because people got to know them. They ended up leading the Democratic ticket, and they won. They were not the expected candidates, but they turned out to be the strongest candidates. And that's what New Hampshire gets, because you look at people and you make a decision. And I hope that the process doesn't get broken down in some way. And I also think that I'll just have to go with whatever cards I'm dealt. And I still believe we'll make that debate.
As we continue on the interview, we're going to focus on some of the issues affecting the middle class here in New Hampshire. Todd Fahey from AARP New Hampshire is with us. Go ahead, Todd.
Hello, hey, Todd. Senator. Good to see you.
Yes.
So we have about 225,000 members of AARP New Hampshire and about 500,000 people over 50 in our fine state. And so for more than a decade, brand name drug prices have gone up significantly faster than the rate of inflation. And a real telling New Hampshire statistic is the price of prescription drug treatment has increased 57.8% between 2012 and 2017. But at the same time, Granite Staters' income increased about 13.2% over that five-year period. So if you're elected president, what's the first thing you'll do to lower drug prices?
Well, we need to unleash the power of 43 million seniors. That's a lot of seniors across the country to get a better deal. And you do that through Medicare. I think it's outrageous that there's a law. There's a law that says Medicare can't negotiate better prices with the pharmaceutical company. So I have been leading the bill since I got to the Senate. I now have 34 senators on it that says we should be able to negotiate, just like the VA does or Medicaid does. They get much better prices. That's the first thing. Also, bringing less expensive drugs from other countries. In Minnesota, we can see Canada from our porch, and we see those cheaper prices over there with safe drugs. And so I think that would create this huge competitive pressure on pharmaceuticals if they even knew that you could have some competition coming in. And then I'd also stop the practice where big pharma companies pay off generic companies to keep their products off the market. That helps both of them, but it doesn't help consumers. I've been leading those efforts bipartisan, and I know as president I could get them done. And the less expensive drugs from other countries, you can do without Congress. You can actually apply for a waiver to bring in those drugs.
Did those make your first 100 days?
That is in my first 100 days because I can do it myself. The others will be pushing those bills through as to get it done, because this is the number one issue, not just for seniors, but for people in this country, is the cost of prescription drugs. And you know why. There's two pharma lobbyists for every member of Congress, and very few of us have been taking this on from the beginning.
Go ahead, Todd.
Another question. So how would you specifically hold the drug companies accountable for the high prescription drug prices? I think you've articulated some of the policy positions, and thank you for that.
Yeah, but it is really taking them on. We are glad we have these companies in America. There's a number of them actually in the Massachusetts area. They've just had the run of the show. They can do whatever they want. So you've got to take them on with antitrust laws. I've led the effort for Democrats on antitrust. There's too much consolidation. And then every time they jerk people around by increased prices for simple things like insulin, you got to take it on.
Do you feel that the drug company should be held responsible for the opioid crisis? Because states like New Hampshire, Minnesota are footing the bill for a lot of what people feel the drug companies did. There have been some lawsuits in regards to this. Do you feel, particularly as a former prosecutor, that the drug company should be held responsible?
I do, and I'm glad there's these lawsuits going on all over the country. I think there'll be one big federal settlement where we want to get the money to the states. We have proof, as I mentioned, on the debate stage. There was an email came out from one of the business executives at one of the companies where he said, keep pushing them out. They're like Doritos to them.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't talking about Doritos. He was talking about drugs that have killed people and have gotten people hooked, even small amounts. In Minnesota, we lost Prince, and we've lost college kids. And you know the stories of towns in New Hampshire that have been decimated by this. So I think we need to do that. And that's one of our big issues for New Hampshire. But I want to point out the one thing when it comes to seniors that I deliberately brought up at that debate stage, because nothing's been happening, and we keep relitigating the Affordable Care Act, and that's long-term care.
Right. Mm-hmm. I may end with that. Social Security, big issue for a lot of grand estaters. Again, a lot of people, for a lot of reasons, they're not ready for retirement. So they come in to retirement, and they rely upon Social Security. It's about $1,400 a month, average benefit in New Hampshire. You know, if nothing happens, no action is taken, there's a shortfall in 2035, resulting, as you know, in cuts in 2026. How would you update and strengthen Social Security and Medicare to keep those fundamental bedrock programs strong for Granite Staters and all Americans?
You know, this is the biggest safety net we have in America. And when people started talking about privatizing Social Security, I was strongly opposed. And right now, we have a strong program, but we have one that we need to continue to shore up as we see more and more people living longer, which is a great thing. We want to make sure it's strong for everyone. And as you point out, it's going to start delivering less if we don't shore it up. My belief is that for Social Security, it's actually fairly easy. Right now, at $133,000 in income, you stop paying in Social Security taxes. What you could do is create kind of a donut hole. So that's true, but then you start paying again at $250,000 and above in income. That would be fair to everyone, and it would mean everyone gets Social Security. When it comes to Medicare, what we just talked about to bring costs down, It would help the government and taxpayers would be pharmaceutical prices under Medicare, as well as making sure that the system is there for our seniors and that we keep it strong and do everything we can to make sure it's high quality.
And one more, as I know you're trying to race around New Hampshire in our nor'easter today, so welcome to New Hampshire.
Come on, I announced in a blizzard. I can handle a little rain.
I understand. Appreciate that, too. A little bit of wind. What's your vision to help Americans live independently in their communities as they age? Big issue for New Hampshire, for our members, you know, second and oldest state in the nation, and people want to stay in place as they age. So what's it look like with a Klobuchar presidency?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd use two words, dignity and choice. And that means some seniors want to live in their homes, and we're seeing that more and more than we did in the old days. So we got to make sure that there's home health care delivery. That's going to be the fastest, one of the fastest growing occupations. There's going to be over 1 million openings in the next 10 years. So you want to make sure we have people filling those jobs that are qualified. That's part of why I'm so focused on not just four-year degrees, right? You want to be able to make sure people can afford long-term care insurance and long-term care. That means keeping Medicaid strong. But a lot of people want to be able to afford their own health care and their own long-term care before they get on Medicaid, and they don't want to go through all their resources. What are the answers there? Affordable long-term care insurance. And I actually got an idea from Boston about a way to pay for this, and that is that people set up trust funds for their kids and that have a lot of money. And if you look at ones that are $500,000 and over, if you just simply tax some of the gain that they make on those, you could get in over $100 billion. And I would put that money toward helping people pay for long-term care insurance premiums so they get that long-term care insurance early, and then helping pay for long-term care. I think, again, this is an exciting thing to work on. The other thing I want to thank AARP for leading on is making sure that seniors that want to keep working can work, and that we see this as part of our workforce. Yeah, we don't have enough people to fill jobs. How about our seniors?
Absolutely.
They're really hard workers, and they want to do it. I don't think they should have to work around the clock, but a lot of them want to work a few hours a week. So why don't we figure that out?
For sure.
Final thing for me is...
By the way, I'm the only candidate in the race so far that has, and you can see it on my on our Twitter feed, not that everyone's on there, I have a 109-year-old endorser, and she did a video for me. Her name's Ruth. She was born in 1910. Come on, this is a good AARP story.
It's a great story. I'm listening.
And she has been through 18 presidents.
Wow.
And so she's a very good judge. She's as smart as could be, incredible woman, and she thinks I should be the 19th. And she wants out of this. She wants to make sure that she gets an invitation to this ceremony and she can bring a friend.
That's cool.
That is a true story. Check it out on our website.
Will do.
Final thing on the middle class in regards to costs. And we have so many families in this state where you'll have an income of $100,000 to $150,000 amongst two individuals, and that's just not enough. Individuals are falling behind. Some even find themselves on food stamps or looking for other ways of assistance. And it's not obviously because they're not making money. It's because of all the other costs that go with living. How, as president, would you go about reducing the costs and debt load on so many middle-class Americans who are making good wages but are just struggling as a result of the debt?
And you got it. That's what this really is about. A lot of people can get jobs, especially here, but they don't always have enough money to cover the costs. So the first thing I look at is let's make sure their wages are good enough, and that means increasing the minimum wage and all kinds of things we can do. But the second thing is let's start whittling away at those costs so they have a little more pocket change so they can go on vacation and save for things. You do that by shoring up Social Security and savings account, looking at the fact that not all of our people are at jobs that you get full-time 401ks. We want to promote 401ks, and that's why this idea for up savings account would let people save a little and their employers contribute at every job they have, and then they add them up to the end, and it's a lot of money, creating a tax environment that allow that to happen, making it easier to afford child care. Looking at that Trump tax bill that contributes to over $1 trillion in debt and changing it, the regressive parts. I mean,
would you focus it more on middle-class tax relief?
Completely. I'd keep the middle-class tax relief in there. But then the tax relief that only helped the wealthy people, I would bring that back. That was unfair, and it added to the debt, and then it was on the shoulders of middle-class people because it added to the debt so much. They're the ones that are going to be left holding the bag if we don't do anything about the debt and if we keep giving away tax giveaways to the money, to the rich. When President went down to Mar-a-Lago, he actually said to his friends after he signed it into law, well, you guys just got a lot richer. Mm-hmm. He thought that was funny. That's what he said.
Yeah.
And we've got to be clear with people, including people that voted for him. Look what he did to you. Let's get some of that money back. We still want to be a successful economic engine here in America. We want people to succeed and do well in the economy. I sure do. I came out of the private sector. But that doesn't mean that you give them a bunch of tax giveaways at the expense of everyone else.
Senator Klobuchar, really appreciate your time, and you're certainly a candidate that deserves New Hampshire's attention.
Yes.
And you've spoken well and articulately on the issues, been here a lot, and it's good to see you
rising
in the polls.
That means a lot. I'm excited, and we'll be back soon, even when it's rain, shine, or snow. You're going to find me here.
That is U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. U.S. Senator Michael Bennett is one of those candidates that is staying in the race and looking to focus on the early primary states, though he is unlikely to ever appear on the national debate stage once again. Bennett spent Wednesday here in the Grand Estate after being here the week prior and is looking to be in New Hampshire on a consistent basis. I'm joined on the program right now by U.S. Senator Michael Bennett from Colorado. He was in the Grand Estate yesterday campaigning for President of the United States. He was not a part of the Democratic presidential debate, which took place on Tuesday night. To talk a little about that and his trip to New Hampshire, a little bit on health care in Syria as well. Senator Bennett, how are you?
I'm doing well, Chris. How are you?
Awesome. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. And as I've said before, folks here in the Granite State should really give you a look. I think you're a great fit for New Hampshire, a strong leader and an individual that I think brings a lot to the conversation. So hopefully you'll get that look here in New Hampshire. But what are you sensing in regards to that? You mentioned in our last interview something that's really stuck, and that is that this is a field that has very soft front runners, in my view, and yours as well. They did not have a strong lead. You don't see the bumper stickers. You don't see, you know, the lawn signs. It feels like there could be movement.
I think that it's because there's been it was a mistake by the DNC to sort of nationalize the race prematurely, to make it all about the debates. And people in Iowa and New Hampshire haven't yet made up their minds. And I think the mind that they're trying to make up is who in this field is best situated to beat Donald Trump. And they're trying to figure that out. They know some people have been around for a while that have name recognition, like Vice President Biden, but they wonder whether he can beat him. And then there are a bunch of new people, and they wonder whether we can beat them, beat him either. So I think that's what people are trying to figure out. And in both states, the people that I've met who are, you know, have been around this for a very long time feel like the decisions are getting made later than ever before in this field. Maybe it's because it's so big.
Yeah, and New Hampshire is a state that does not determine who it's going to vote for really until later, but it feels like that there's usually a lot more support for the quote-unquote front runners at this point in time, real tangible support, and it doesn't feel like that's the case during this cycle. Want to talk to you a little bit about Medicare for All, and you have talked extensively about this, and we saw it in the debate brought up once again, where Elizabeth Warren just is not being honest in regards to what Medicare for All is and what Medicare for All is going to cost, particularly middle-class taxpayers. And I feel like this is not something that you can just spring on, you know, during the general election or spring on if you become president of the United States, like, oh, this is what's going to take place. There has to be a conversation so individuals know if, in fact, they're going to support this, what type of pain this is going to bring to American citizens.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, Chris, I've been, I think, maybe uniquely in the field, been consistently led on the public option since we passed the Affordable Care Act in 2010. That is my position now with Medicare X, which is a bill I wrote long before I ran for president, that would give everybody in America the choice of they want to stay on their private insurance down. If they want to get on a public option administered by Medicare, they could do that too. It raises taxes on nobody, and it actually improves the country's fiscal situation. It's hard to know what's not to like about that, and I think we could get to universal health care in 3 years. Medicare for All, which I've been pointing out from the very beginning, makes illegal insurance for private insurance for everybody in America except cosmetic insurance. And Bernie tells us it would cost somewhere around $32 trillion. Now, Bernie's been totally honest about that, and he believes the American people are willing to pay $32 trillion in taxes for the privilege of giving up their choice of private insurance. And I respect his ideological commitment to his position. I just disagree that that's what the American people want. And I don't believe that's what they want. I think substantively, it's a lousy position, but politically, it's a terrible position. And particularly if you can't tell the truth about how it's going to be paid for. And Bernie has told the truth about how he can pay for half of it, about $16 billion. And he will be raising taxes on everybody making, I think it's $29,000 and above, and on businesses as well. And I don't know what Elizabeth is going to use to pay for that, but just to give you a sense of how extraordinarily large that is, $32 trillion is the equivalent of 70% of everything we're going to spend on the federal or all the revenue that the federal government's going to collect over the next 10 years.
And I think that's a really good way to look at that. And you consider all the federal government does at this point in time, including running a Medicare system for retirees. And
exactly.
That's
right.
The type of astronomical cost that is going to be is really eye-opening. I want to get your sense for the race as a whole, because to me, there's three lanes right now. There's Joe Biden, who represents a steady, calm return to America's past, a normalcy, if you will, in the White House, that some folks yearn for, the Obama years, etc. There is the Bernie and Elizabeth Warren lane, which is one that represents a fundamental change to our country in many different ways. And then there's, to me, the middle lane. And Pete Buttigieg had a good night, and there's a lot of other candidates that could potentially fill that lane. That's the new leadership lane, where there's a progressive ideals, but somebody that is going to bring the country right in a different direction. Do you see, despite the fact that the numbers indicate that there's more, obviously that Warren and Sanders and Biden are doing best, I still feel like that middle lane is the most populated in terms of voters and really where folks want to go and to find a new leader.
I don't think there's any question about it. I mean, I think those guys are doing well because they've got a lot of name recognition, and I understand it, and they've earned it. I mean, by Joe Biden being vice president, Bernie Sanders running before, Elizabeth Warren's very well known. But I just don't think the American people, are ready to sign up for something that's like basically free stuff that, unfunded programs and empty promises. I really don't think that's where the American people are. I think somebody who's going to actually tell the truth about where we have to head in the future, not take us back to the past, but where we have to head in the future. Do you have an agenda that actually unifies the American people so that we can not just unify the Democratic base, which is really important, but win back some of the 9 million people that voted twice for Barack Obama and once for Donald Trump, and create opportunity for Americans? Americans don't want free stuff. They want opportunity. And for the last 50 years, they haven't had enough opportunity because, we've had a terrible lack of economic mobility in the country and an education system that unfortunately is reinforcing the economic immobility that we have in large part because we're not funding it properly. I mean, the plans that I have put forward in this campaign are targeted directly at trying to drive opportunity for the American people, and I think that's what the American people want.
Quickly on Syria, because I know you have to catch a plane here.
I literally have to catch a plane. I'm still trying to get my lobster roll.
I got
a lot of multitasking.
Yeah, there's a lot of
Chris.
Things going on there, but you have to get a lobster roll before you leave New England. That's
got
definitely
to,
key. Is this the lowest point in the Trump administration, in your view, what has happened in Syria, the bloodshed that we have on our hands as a result of this?
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of low points, but is this the lowest point?
I think it's the most pathetically weak foreign policy decision that any American president has made in generations. And no other Republican president would have done what Donald Trump did, and no other Democratic president would have done what he did. No patriotic American president would have done what he did in Syria. I mean, for 5 years, you know, we had a successful effort to root out ISIS and destroy ISIS, and we lost 6 people in that theater. The Kurds have lost 12,000 people, and Donald Trump has one conversation with Erdogan from Turkey, the president of Turkey, and the next thing you know, we're walking away with our tail between our legs, abandoning our allies. And by the way, he says he's taking troops out of the Middle East, but while he's taking that, just that thousand, that group of 1,000 troops that were there to keep this mayhem from happening, and have been keeping the mayhem from happening for 5 years, you know, he's putting another 15,000 in because of, you know, the trouble that we're facing from, you know, Iran, and he's sending troops to Saudi Arabia. So it just doesn't, it's completely incoherent. I mean, utterly incoherent.
You're absolutely right. And the letter that he wrote to Erdogan was bizarre, and the threats in that. And Erdogan said, you know what, I'm placing this in the trash, and I'm moving forward. You got to catch a plane. We'll talk again soon, right?
The guy, you know what, it would be nice to have a president who actually supported our allies and did not coddle tyrants and wasn't intimidated by tyrants. And Trump is.
Yeah, it's bizarre. I will appreciate your time. Talk to you
all
again
right,
soon.
Chris. Thanks for having me.
That is U.S. Senator Michael Bennett from Colorado. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. For information, check out nhhca.org. When we return, Paul Steinhauser and I at the Barley House. So we wrap up this edition of On Background and give you a clue as to who's going to be coming to the Granite State in the next little bit, as visits from Elizabeth Warren as well as Pete Buttigieg are on the horizon. That next, here on Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Welcome back. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. We are inside the Barley House today, home to WKXL's Pints of Politics series. We talked with Amy Klobuchar here in the front window just a few moments ago. She is in New Hampshire today and is taking part in a 10-county in 30-hour tour. She's going to be back a lot, she said.
That breaks the
record. Here a lot.
Because Beto O'Rourke, back in March, did those 10 counties, but he took about 2.5 days. She's doing it in about a day and a half.
That's true. She's rolling right through.
Yeah.
So she's going to be here a lot. Pete Buttigieg is going to be here a lot, and those are the two candidates that did really well out of the debate. Cory Booker is back this weekend. What else are we seeing in terms of candidates on the ground?
Yeah, Booker's here Sunday and Monday, mostly on the western part of the state. And as you mentioned, Buttigieg is coming back late next week. He'll be here in Concord, NHTI, and a bunch of other stops as well in the Seacoast region and across the state. Yeah, we're going to see the former vice president coming back in the next few weeks. That's what his people have told me. There's no set date yet. Andrew Yang is going to be back as well. So we've got a lot of candidates coming. It's been busy. It's going to remain busy.
Elizabeth Warren back next week as well, I believe, on Thursday and Friday, including an event in Warner, which I believe is on Thursday, so close here in the Capital Region. That is Paul Steinhauser. I am Chris Ryan. You've been listening to On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, the show that is all about the First Nation presidential primary. We mentioned Pete Buttigieg. He's going to join us on Background next week to talk about his trip to the Granite State and how he looks to expand upon his support after a strong debate performance. For Paul Steinhauser, I am Chris Ryan. Have a great rest of the day, everybody.